This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our first guest is the creator of the ABC sitcom Black-ish, Kenya Barris. Black-ish is about a 40-ish husband and father, Andre, who goes by the name Dre. He grew up in a poor neighborhood and is now an advertising executive, living in a predominantly white suburb with his biracial wife, who's a doctor, and their four children. In the pilot, he's promoted to vice president of the urban division, which leads him to think he's become the token black executive. He's afraid his privileged children are becoming too assimilated into white culture. Dre's son is also named Andre, but his white friends call him Andy, which sounds all wrong to Dre. And the son has a lot of Jewish friends, and he wants a big bar mitzvah party like the ones they're having, so he's considering converting and changing his name to Shlomo or Shmuel. In this scene, the father, played by Anthony Anderson, decides it's time to draw the line and calls a family meeting.
All right, listen up. I may have to be urban at work, but I'm still going to need my family to be black. Not black-ish, but black. So we're going to start with some strict guidelines.
So then he sent me a smiley face with a wink. I mean, I should be offended, right?
Zoe!
I'll text you.
All right. From here to forth, we are going to keep it real. So, Junior, if I hear anybody calling you Shlomo or Shmuel or especially Andy, I'm going to back you over and whoever else is saying it in my car.
Dad.
Quiet! Now, I may have to watch you play possibly the dumbest sport in the world, but I do not have to sit back and listen to you rave about other kids' bar mitzvahs. So, next Saturday, when you turn 13, you're becoming a man too. A black man, because I'm throwing you an African rites of passage ceremony. Ha!
That does not sound as fun.
No, it does not.
Okay, I have an idea. Why don't we take a black break and go get some white yogurt?
Yeah!
That's a scene from the first episode of Black-ish. Kenya Barris, welcome to Fresh Air. How'd you come up with the premise for the series?
I came up with the premise by living a day in my life with my kids. I was laughing listening to that because it so reminds me of a moment I would have had with my kids. And it really was based on my family. You know, my wife she's an anesthesiologist. She's mixed. My kids are growing up in a different situation than
but
I
mixed,
grew up in.
Do you mean
she's black and white.
Yeah, right. She has a white parent and a black parent. Yeah.
Her dad's white and her mom is black. Mm-hmm. And we came from a different situation than our kids, and me and my wife are both from different situations. And we're raising our kids up. Me in particular, my kids are nothing like I remember, quote unquote, black kids being when I was a kid. So I'm sort of trying to navigate what that's going to be for me. You know, you're taught to give your kids more, but in giving them more, like, what do they lose? And I think that sort of was the conceit and premise of the show.
So you changed class when you were a child in a way because there was this sudden influx of money. Do you want to explain what happened?
Yeah, a couple of things happened. My father lost a lung in a chemical accident at General Motors. And after a while, he got a settlement that sort of changed all of our lives and moved us from what we, you know, say ashy to classy in some aspects. At the same time, my mother had gotten her real estate license and, you know, she was really, really entrepreneurial and started selling real estate. And, you know, her life sort of changed around that same time. And we basically, my sister and brother had started going to, you know, had gotten into college and went going to USC. And it was all of a sudden we sort of went from one segment of the socioeconomic ladder and we sort of went up a rung. And it was, around the time for me where I was just old enough to kind of see really both sides. And it really influenced who I am.
So did you change neighborhoods?
I did. We changed neighborhoods. We changed schools.
Compare the before and after.
Ashy to classy. it's interesting. I feel like when you live in a lower economic neighborhood, one of the things that's really, really endearing about that is that you really don't know it until you're not in it. Because there's something really sort of unifying to everyone is sort of broke. You know, and it's not until you sort of go to different schools and things like that that you're able to look back and be like, wow, we were really broke. But, you know, there's a unifying presence that everyone wants to get out of that situation. You're kind of, you know, together in a struggle to sort of have more. But it's not until you have a little bit more that you really realize how little that you had. And so I kind of feel like that is, You know, for me, one of the things that I sort of worry about with my kids is that they will not have that context to sort of understand what their life is and what it could be.
In your show, Black-ish, it's as if the children are growing up in a different country than the parents did because of technology, you know, because of like social media and cell phones, and also because of class, and because they don't think as much about race, because race isn't separating them from mainstream culture in America the way it did for the parents, or at least for the father. And therefore, things that mean so much to the father, like witnessing the inauguration of the first Black president, don't mean that much to the kids because it's all they know. So they just take it for granted, like that's the way it is. So
there was a moment in the pilot that we put where Jack didn't know that Obama was the first Black president. And that really happened to me in my life. We actually were walking through the Atlanta airport when the inauguration was going on, and people were crying and this and that, and my son didn't quite understand, you know, what was happening. We had to explain, like, it's the first Black president. And he's like, he's the first Black president? You know, and years later, we had a conversation when he's a little bit older, and he's like, we're like, you really remember that he was the first Black president? That's why those people were crying. He was like, oh, I forgot about that. And I'm like, how could you forget about that? And we realized that's the only president he's ever known. And for him, a president is Black. And there's something sort of really nice about that. And there's also something sort of, for who I am, a little scary, because I want him to know how big of an accomplishment that is and how, you know, for the country, not just for our people, just for the country. And I don't know if he gets the context.
The father in Black-ish is concerned that his kids are picking up white norms and that they don't have, like, a Black cultural context the way he did. And, like, in the clip that we just heard, examples are that, you know, the father's name is Andre. He calls himself Dre. His son is Andre. But the kids at school are calling him Andy. His white friends are calling him Andy. And the father just, like, hates that. And the son wants to get, you know, bar mitzvahed so he can have a lavish party like he sees his Jewish friends having. So the father decides, well, you're going to have a Black rites of passage ceremony. You're going to have, you know, an African rites of passage ceremony. And that seems very righteous to the father and very boring and pointless to the son. And it just made me wonder if there were in your family generational differences on Afrocentricity.
Absolutely. You know, actually, that particular story was an aggregate of Lawrence Fishburne, Anthony Anderson, and myself. Anthony Anderson actually has the copyright to the word bro mitzvah.
Because that's really great. Yeah.
And because his son, you know, who was the only, as he calls him, the only little chocolate drop in his class, Anthony's from Compton, but, you know, he's been working in the entertainment industry for 20 some odd years and had some successes. And so his family were, you know, his kids in particular came up in a different situation. His son came in, and I remember this when I started going to the schools. I remember that 12, 13, 14-year-old point where you're just going week to week to week to bar mitzvahs. And his son was doing that, and we don't have that in our culture. And we don't have, you know, they're lavish. There's money, there's bands, and there's groups, and there's parties. It's like, why can't we have this? And so his son came in and was like, I want a bar mitzvah. And it really freaked Anthony out, and he said, I want a bro mitzvah. And Lawrence said there was a time like that with his kid, and he gave his kids an African white rites of passage ceremony. And I remember getting that. But I remember, you know, when I was telling me about it, I remember thinking how not fun it was. My generation, I believe, was the first generation to really benefit directly from the civil rights movement. In my house, it was more of a militant, you know, approach to it, more of a sort of disdainful. My mom, you know, went through civil rights. My dad went through civil rights. My name was Kenya because they wanted to give me an African name. And subsequently, my generation sort of took more of a, because we didn't really have, you know, foot to pavement or rubber to road type of marches and things like that. We took more of an intellectual sort of revolutionary approach. There was Public Enemy and Malcolm X, you know, Autobiography of Malcolm X exploded. You know, there was the Malcolm X movie. There was Spike Lee. We sort of became more of philosophical revolutionaries. And now my kids and their generation, one of the moments I remember when I was pitching the show that really sparked for me is the Trayvon Martin incident happened. And my daughter, you know, came in and I was like, you know, how do you feel about this? And she was like, you know, we're really upset. And she's like, every kids I know are protesting. And I'm like, oh, that's awesome. I'm like, what are you doing? And she said, you know, look, we're doing it on Instagram. And she shows me this Instagram picture and it's just a black frame. It's like the picture, it's just an all black thing. And I'm like, okay, so where's the protest? She's like, this is it. Look how many people are putting black on their Instagram. And I realized that this must be the most low rent protest I've ever seen in my life. I was like, I can't get like a small trash can fire. Like, I don't know, like anything. Like, and it really showed me the generational difference. And, you know, I think that that is one of the reasons I did an episode this year called Hope, where the family at the end, there was an incident, and the family decides to go down to the protest. And we really try to make sure we end our shows not saying any one way to be is the right way to be. But I wanted in this particular episode to say, I do think that something that we have to do as a people is, not just as a Black people, I mean, as a country, is really actually be more proactive, no matter what we do. I think that that is something that the digital age kind of takes away from us. You know what I'm saying? We feel like we can sign online protests and do that. But I think we have to actually put rubber to road, foot to pavement, and be more proactive.
Let's talk about that episode called Hope. This is the family figuring out how to answer questions that are unanswerable, questions from their children. So everybody is around the TV watching as the news is about to come down about whether a police officer accused of misconduct is going to be indicted or not. And what he's accused of is tasering 37 times a man, a Black man, who was selling DVDs. And so, you know, they're watching. There's protesters kind of surrounding the site. And the family's watching this on TV. And it comes down that this officer is not going to be indicted. And then protests really break out. There's reports of fires and looting. And, you know, the children are wondering, like, especially the young six-year-old is wondering, like, why is everybody so mad? So the parents are trying to explain to them. And then they get into a kind of debate about the police and the justice system. And the mother is kind of defending some faith in the justice system, like the children have to learn how to, like, be polite to the cops because ultimately the justice system works. And the father and grandfather are very skeptical of that idea. And she says, well, I don't want my kids to grow up in an environment where there's no hope. So this is a conversation between the father, Anthony Anderson, who plays Dre, and his wife, Rainbow, who's played by Tracy Ellis Ross.
Don't you get it, Bo? The system is rigged against us.
Maybe it is, Dre. But I don't want to feel like my kids are living in a world that is so flawed that they can't have any hope.
Oh, so you want to talk about hope, Bo? Obama ran on hope. Remember when he got elected? And we felt like maybe, just maybe, we got out of that bad place and made it to a good place. That the whole country was really ready to turn the corner. You remember that amazing feeling we had during the inauguration? I was sitting right next to you, and we were so proud. And we saw him get out of that limo and walk alongside of it and wave to that crowd. Tell me you weren't terrified when you saw that. Tell me you weren't worried that someone was going to snatch that hope away from us like they always do. That is the real world, Bo. And our children need to know that that's the world that they live in.
So that's a scene from Black-ish, and that was Anthony Anderson that we heard. And my guest is the creator and showrunner of Black-ish, Kenya Barris. So you kind of spoke the unspeakable in that, because I think there's so many people who have been so worried for, was it 7 years now, that, you know, that somebody would do something to President Obama, you know, and I don't even want to say the word. And it's like you were directly addressing that fear in that, in addition to kind of getting to the injustice of the justice system.
I mean, it's so weird. I kind of like am getting choked up a little bit. Like hearing that on the radio, it's different than seeing it on television. The words are a little bit more piercing. Wow. Anthony did a really, really good job. And I think, yes, you know, I was terrified when I was writing that because I was like, this is not what the show is. It's a comedy. And, you know, we had to, I was struggling during the writing process to sort of make sure keeping the tone. Ultimately, that episode, although it's really kind of, you know, taken on a life of its own, was not at its inception about police brutality. It was something that was a really good lens to sort of focus our cameras on, but it really started from the conceit and the inception of the idea was that we're living in this world right now where you have so many things that are coming up. You know, there's terrorist act, there's racism, there's brutality, there's sexism, there's, you know, we're in a really tumultuous political moment right now, and I feel like there's so many things that your kids cannot be tuned out from because of 24-hour news, TMZ, the internet, you know, other kids, you know, whatever. They can't sort of the one time ability to sort of turn off the outside world and just kind of raise our kids is gone. So it really was like, how do you have conversations with your kids about things that you're not necessarily wanting to have conversations with them about? And how do you have those conversations and not let your past experiences sort of scorch the earth of what their future is going to be? And we took the idea of police brutality because we felt like it was something, you know, so organic to what we're going through right now and what this family would be going through. And it actually really that particular moment actually really happened with me. And so I really wanted to tell that conversation. And I think that moment of television for me is probably the most special thing I'll ever be involved in. I just don't think as a comedy writer you get to be involved in things like that. And you never know it's going to happen. It kind of sort of happened on its own. But it was a cathartic week for everybody involved.
So let me ask you about a story that you have not, to my knowledge, used on Black-ish.
Okay.
And this is a story from your own life. Your father was abusive. Your mother left him mm-hmm. with the children. She took the children and left him. And then one night, I'm not sure how old you were, he broke into the house. Mm-hmm. And she had a gun and shot and wounded him. And I think mm-hmm. you were watching while it happened. She told you to call the police. You did. What went through your mind when you witnessed that?
I mean, I don't, you know, it was, I think probably like, oh, shit. Like, you know, like it kind of was like.
How old were you?
I probably was 5 or 6. It all happened so fast. I think I knew pretty quickly that he was going to be okay. You know, he went away on his own, you know, feet. And shortly after that, we saw him in the hospital, you know. So I think I pretty quickly knew that he was going to be okay. I think I was really more so worried about my mom, you know, to see her not in her, you know, normal. My mom was not a crier. My mom was not, you know, she was a very, very strong lady. And to see her sort of not composed, you know, it was something I was not used to. So I think that was one of the bigger things. I feel like, and maybe as I'm saying this to you, I'm like, wow, I'm a sociopath. I think part of it was kind of fun. I know that sounds crazy, but it was like the police came and they came and showed me I showed him my room and I was like, you know, I heard a gun go off. And I don't think at that time you're thinking necessarily, you know, you saw the person walk out, they're going to be okay. It kind of was just like, oh, this is sort of maybe an exciting moment. And like, it was a very whirlwind situation. I was talking to my mom about this and she was trying to talk to me about like my recollection and opposed to hers. I mean, it was such a, I think sort of like, cyclone that it hit me. And I think that's the beauty of being young, is that you're malleable and you can sort of bend, and but at the same time you bounce back really well.
You know, a really strange twist to this is that the father who your mother had left, who then broke into the house really angry, he'd been abusive, she shot him later, and you can tell us how many years later, he had that industrial accident that ended in the loss of a lung, and it was the settlement money from the subsequent lawsuit that helped fund your mother's ability to move you to a better neighborhood and better schools.
It's so interesting you say. I didn't even look at it like that, and I think that's one of the things that my upbringing and, you know, seeing my mom and seeing my dad, who's, you know, for all whatever, you know, things he have been through, you know, he went through troubles in his marriage like everyone does. My dad was a really good dad. I never was a time where my dad was absent in my life. He just wasn't there. You know, living with me and my mom, and I chose, you know, I think a lot of kids doing divorce, I chose my mom, you know. But like, you know, I always could get my dad if I knew him. You know, I think that moment changed my dad for the good part. He has a special needs kid that I've never seen someone take more interest in. You know, I feel like it made my mom became like a, you know, she was Joan of Arc after that. You know, like, she really...
After she shot him, she was Joan of Arc?
Absolutely. She was a force to be reckoned with. And she went on and became very, very successful on her own. And, you know, took money and things that came in her life and did really well with them. And to this day, if I have financial issues, I'll go to my mom almost before I go to my business manager.
So one of the new developments on your show, Black-ish, is that the wife and mother, who's also a doctor on the show, is pregnant. And she's probably, she already has four kids, and she's probably, what, in her early 40s? And you're
40.
Mm-hmm. 40. Okay. And your wife is pregnant now. Mm-hmm. And she's probably roughly the same age as the character on the show, I'm guessing.
39.
Okay.
39. Mm-hmm.
And so do you plan on working in a lot of her pregnancy and the birth of your new child into episodes next season?
Absolutely. We don't want it to be...
Nothing goes to waste.
No. Yes. We don't want it to be... exactly. I'm living this life so that I can monetize it. And I think that it really, we wanted to speak to the notion that women are having babies later. You know, women are having babies while they have really big careers. Men are having to sort of take different roles in that. You know, there is so much stuff with, you know, fertility and things like that. I feel like we wanted to sort of talk about some of those stories and some of those things that go on. You know, my wife was told she had a geriatric womb.
Oh, that's on the show, too. Yeah.
Yes.
It sounds so horrible, a geriatric uterus.
It sounds awful. Yeah. Could you imagine if men went into the doctor and they're like, you have a geriatric penis? Like, they would come up with a different way to say that very quickly.
Yeah. You know, that's definitely true.
And it was very interesting that that was sort of, you know, something that was told to her with a straight face. And, you know, I want to talk about, I've had so many friends going through fertility issues and just the notion of having a later in life child and, you know, while at the same time maybe having issues with your, you know, finances. And I think that there is really rich layering and texture to these stories.
Well, I'll be looking to see how it turns out on this series and in your life. Kenya Barris, it's been great talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kenya Barris spoke with Terry last Wednesday. He's the creator of the ABC sitcom Black-ish. The show's second season ended Wednesday night. You can watch episodes of Black-ish on Hulu. Our critic at large, John Powers, has a review of a new film that he says is bursting with the worldly pleasures that made him love movies in the first place. It's called A Bigger Splash, and it was made by the Italian filmmaker Luca Guadagnino, who also directed the art house hit I Am Love. It stars Tilda Swinton, Ralph Fiennes, and Dakota Johnson in a tale of love, jealousy, and longing.
Every movie is set somewhere, yet most movies feel as if they're happening nowhere at all. They're set in a Manhattan so generic that the filming was actually done in Toronto, or in a Paris we only know as Paris because we get a shot of the Eiffel Tower, or in an imaginary small town from some unnamed state, whose purpose is to be every small town. Such settings have no presence, no weight, no humidity, no purpose. They're background. If you want to enjoy a location being used properly and alluringly, let me suggest A Bigger Splash, the gripping slow burn film by Luca Guadagnino, the Italian director who made I Am Love, the swooningly romantic hit film starring Tilda Swinton. Set on the Mediterranean island of Pantelleria, where the likes of Madonna and Giorgio Armani go for R&R, this remake of a 1969 French thriller offers the brand of grown-up entertainment that's all but vanished from our theaters. Swinton stars as Marianne, a Bowie-ish rock star who's recovering from a throat surgery that keeps her from speaking for nearly the whole film. She's rented a villa with her boyfriend Paul. That's the Belgian actor Matthias Schoenaerts, a photographer who's recovering from a psychological crisis. They're having an idyllic time until they get a call from Marianne's old producer and lover, Harry Hawks, played by Ralph Fiennes. Before they know what's hit them, they're hosting Harry and his nubile daughter, Penelope. She's Dakota Johnson from 50 Shades of Grey. Here, the four first meet at the island's airport, and it's instantly clear that Fiennes' garrulous Harry is going to be the quartet's ringmaster.
Hey! Is it you? Is it you? Yes! God, I am so happy to see you! Oh, why didn't you let me know you were here? You know I love this place. I'm in Rome all summer. You can talk, can't you? Come on, tell me you're better. Yes, you are. What? Ah, what, not at all?
Well, the doctor said 2 more weeks.
It's the kid. Hey, come here. You look fantastic.
Oh, thanks.
You look sexy. You kind of look metro-sexy.
I'm sorry we didn't call, but we're hiding out.
What? Hiding out? Well, not from me. Come on. Not anymore, anyway.
come on. When I'm finished with you, you'll be singing in those gravelly jeans again. Oh, Penn, come here. Right, Penn, meet Marianne and Paul.
Oh, you brought a protege. Aha. Nice to meet you.
I'm his daughter.
The newcomer's arrival shatters Marianne and Paul's quiet holiday. It's not simply that Harry is a hyperkinetic life of the party, but that he wants everyone else to get with the program. Even as he works to win Marianne back to their old excesses and ecstasies, a life she's outgrown, his daughter appears to be making eyes at Paul. As old memories and resentments bubble up, you sense that something bad is going to happen. These shifting psychological dynamics are deftly caught by Guadagnino, who skillfully orchestrates the quartet's varying energies, from Chernet's wary Paul, whose still waters run deep, to Johnson's unreadable Penelope, a young vixen whose silence always feels a tad insolent. As for Swinton, long before she became a fine actress, she was an extraordinary creature that no camera could resist. Certainly Guadagnino's can't. She's his muse. He looks raptly, sometimes rapturously, at her lanky body and cool otherworldly features. Swinton's mere being makes Marianne the eye of the emotional storm. The storm itself is Harry, the sort of whirling dervish character I nearly always find annoying and unconvincing. But in recent years, Fiennes, who was always a terrific actor, has discovered a rich new vein of joy in his work. He turns Harry into a dazzling creation. Whether telling old stories, dancing to the Rolling Stones, or skinny dipping in the pool, Fiennes gives us the definitive portrait of a man whose embrace of life's pleasures is fueled by desperation. The movie is worth seeing for Fiennes and Swinton. Yet what makes it doubly seductive is Guadagnino's skill at revealing social privilege from the inside. In I Am Love, he gave us the sumptuous textures of upper-class Milan. You could almost feel the fabrics. Here, he gives us the Pantelleria that is at once a playground for the entitled and a way station for illegal North African migrants, who serve as the film's, and maybe the filmmaker's, guilty conscience. Guadagnino makes you feel the island in all its real-life tactility. The light may be gorgeous, but there's also heat making you sweat, mosquitoes to swat, and watch out for the snakes. Marianne and Paul's villa may be enviable, but its rooms aren't particularly large or posh. The best meal takes place at a roadside joint, where the quartet eats great food off plastic tables, the quintessence of shabby chic. This is how the rich live. Guadagnino clearly knows their world in all its details, and on a bigger splash, he plunges us into its many comforts and corruptions. Walking out of the theater, you'll know that the movie has done something that movies ought to do. It has lifted you out of your seat and taken you to a place that's really a place.
John Powers is film and TV critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. He co-wrote a new book with filmmaker Wong Kar-wai called WKW, The Cinema of Wong Kar-wai. Our guest is the winner of this year's Pulitzer Prize for Fiction, Viet Thanh Nguyen. His novel, The Sympathizer, is set during and just after the war in Vietnam and is told in the form of a forced confession written by a spy who worked for the North Vietnamese, going undercover as an aide to a South Vietnamese general and his staff. It appears that part of his crime is sympathizing with the suffering on both sides. That sympathy is in part a function of his own divided self. The character's mother grew up in North Vietnam. His father was a French colonialist in Vietnam. Viet Thanh Nguyen's parents grew up in the north of Vietnam. When the country was divided in the mid-1950s, with the north going under communist control, his parents fled to the south. When the south fell to the north in 1975, the family fled to America. Viet was 4 years old. He's now a professor of English and American Studies and Ethnicity at the University of Southern California. He spoke with Terry last Tuesday.
Viet Thanh Nguyen, welcome to Fresh Air. Why did you want to write this novel from the point of view of a spy?
Well, when my agent told me I should write a novel, the first thing that came to me was a spy novel, and partly it was because it's a genre that I really enjoy, and I wanted to write a novel that was actually entertaining, that people would actually want to read, because I knew that I would also be dealing with a lot of very serious, you know, political and literary matters. And then the other inspiration for that was that there really were spies in South Vietnam that rose to the very highest ranks of the South Vietnamese bureaucracy and military. And there was a very famous spy named Phạm Xuân An who was so important that during his time as a mole, he was promoted to a major general by the North Vietnamese. And he was friends with people like David Halberstam and all the important American journalists, and they had no idea that he was a communist spy who had studied in the United States. So all these factors were in my mind.
The war in Vietnam was central to your whole family's story. In 1975, when Saigon fell, and your parents' town had already been taken over by the North Vietnamese, your family fled. So it was you, your parents, and your brother?
Yeah. I mean, the story was that in March 1975, my father had gone to Saigon on business, and my mother was at home in Ban Ma Thuot with myself, my brother, and my adopted sister, who was the oldest sibling. So March 1975, the communist army invades, seizes the town, cuts off all communication. My mother can't communicate with my father, so she takes her life, our lives, into her hands and decides to flee the town on foot with my brother, who is 10 years old, and myself, who was 4, and leaves behind my adopted sister, who was about 16, to take care of the family property because she believed, and reasonably so, that we would be back because this is the way the war had happened for the last 10 or 15 years. You know, seesaw battles and people would leave and they get to go back. Well, of course, we never got to go back. And my mom walked downhill to Nha Trang, that port town of about 150 miles south, and the best I can say about that is that at least it was all downhill, and that I don't remember any of it, even though my brother does and says it was horrible, and the historical accounts that I've read indicate that it was chaos and death and lots of civilians and southern Vietnamese soldiers dead along the way. We caught a boat from Nha Trang to Saigon, met up with my father, fortunately enough, and then a month later, the communists came and took Saigon. And according to my brother, you know, we tried various ways to get out of the city, went to the airport, couldn't get out. Finally, we made it onto, we found a barge, but we got separated. So again, my father was somewhere else, my mother was with us, and without knowing where my father was, my mother decided to get on that boat. And then later we discovered my father had gotten on that boat too. So my parents have always been risk takers, and for us, most of the time it's worked out.
Most people form their earliest memories at around, I think, the age of 3 or 4. So, like, your earliest memories have to do with the war and with trying to escape and with being separated from your father. How do you think that affected your view of the world or you're just like your basic identity?
Well, I have vague images of pre-April 1975 Saigon, which are not reliable. You know, for example, I thought I remembered that when we were on that boat leaving Saigon that sailors were shooting at smaller fishing boats that were trying to come up to us. And my brother said, no, that never happened. But then I read somewhere else that it did happen. But my most reliable memory really begins after we had come to the United States, and we, all Vietnamese refugees, in order to come to the United States, were settled in these refugee camps, and ours was Fort Indian Town Gap, Pennsylvania. And in order to leave one of these camps, you had to have sponsors take you. No sponsor would take my family of 4, so my brother went to one family, my parents went to one family, and at 4 years old, I was sent to live with a white family. And that's when my memory begins, and of being separated from my parents. And even though that was only for a few months, it was really traumatic for me. And it's taken me a long time to understand how deeply traumatic that was, that that experience remains an invisible brand stamped between my shoulder blades. And in many ways, I spent a lifetime trying to make sense of what that trauma has meant to me.
Did the family you were staying with take good care of you?
I think I stayed with 2 families, if I remember right. I think the first family was in a mobile home. They were young. They had no idea what to do with me. And I, now being the father of a 3-year-old, I can just imagine what kind of a terror I was at 4 years old, separated from my parents in a strange household. So then I was sent to another family with children, and they did take very good care of me. I remember them with fondness, but also remember that, you know, they tried to make me comfortable. And one of the ways that they did that was to give me a pair of chopsticks. And they all had chopsticks. And they said, show us how to use chopsticks. At 4 years old, I had no idea how to use chopsticks. And I felt very badly about that. And that was, I think, my first initiation into the sense of being culturally and racially different than other Americans.
So after, about 3 years or so, your family moved from Pennsylvania to San Jose. But you're right, the violence they sought to escape caught up with them. After they opened up their Vietnamese grocery store, they were shot one Christmas Eve during a holdup of their store. What happened?
I don't know. I was very young when that happened, and I was probably less than 10 years old, because I remember it was Christmas Eve. I was watching Scooby-Doo Christmas. My brother got a phone call, said to me, hey, Mom and Dad have been shot. And I had no reaction. I just wanted to watch my cartoon. It's not as if I didn't care. I didn't know what to do with that incident. And then I remember my brother yelling at me because I didn't react. And it was really difficult, you know, to try to understand what was happening to my parents and to my brother and myself there, that there was violence, because my parents were shopkeepers, and this is what happens to immigrant shopkeepers. They get robbed, they get beaten, they get shot all the time.
Were you afraid in the store after that?
I hated that store. You know, I am thankful to my parents that they were not the kind of, I mean, they made me do certain kinds of things, like do the accounting and all of that, but they rarely actually made me go physically to the store to help them do that kind of work, and I didn't like being there. And I think they didn't make me do these kinds of things because they wanted me to study. They sacrificed their lives in order for my brother and I to always have food, to always have clothing, and to always have an education, and to have religion. Those were their priorities, but they didn't want us to become shopkeepers and to do their kind of work. So fortunately, we were protected from that.
Do you remember when you started realizing that there was an enormous conflict in the United States about the war in Vietnam, and that the war had really divided America?
Well, I knew that we were different as Vietnamese people really early. And, you know, soon after we came to San Jose, California, my parents had opened this grocery store, and I walked on that street and I saw a sign in the window that said, another American business driven out by Vietnamese people. So that was my first sense that somehow we had arrived in a place that looked at us as different. And then not long after that, the VCR arrived on the scene, and I was about 10 years old. We got a VCR, and one of the first movies that I remember watching was Apocalypse Now. I was probably about 10, and I think that was the first indication also that I had that there was something called this war, and that this is how Americans saw this war, as one that had divided them. And that was my first glimmering that there was something like a civil war happening in the American soul, and that we as Vietnamese people were caught up in that. Because I watched that movie as a good American boy who had already seen some American war movies, John Wayne and World War II, and I was cheering for the American soldiers until the moment in Apocalypse Now where they started killing Vietnamese people. And that was an impossible moment for me, because I didn't know who I was supposed to identify with, the Americans who were doing the killing or the Vietnamese who were dying, and not being able to speak. And that moment has never left me as the symbolic moment of my understanding that this was our place in an American war, that the Vietnam War was an American war from the American perspective, and that eventually I would have to do something about that.
Well, you kind of work that out a little bit in your new novel, because the main character, the spy, after the fall of Saigon, when he comes to the U.S., he ends up being an advisor on a film called The Hamlet that's very much modeled on Apocalypse Now. It's like your fictional version of Apocalypse Now. And in the acknowledgments for your book, you mentioned like a whole bunch of like books and movies that you like read or watched that have to do with Apocalypse Now. So your spy is like an advisor on this movie. What is expected of him?
Well, he's an advisor on this movie, which is certainly, you know, clearly alluding to Apocalypse Now, but it's really a compilation of all the movies that I'd seen about the Vietnam War, because Apocalypse Now is actually a great movie, even though it traumatized me, and it's a problematic movie, but so many of the movies that were made about the Vietnam War were not that great, and The Hamlet is going to be one of these films. But his job on this film is to be the authenticity consultant. And, you know, his basic understanding of this is that Hollywood is interested in the authenticity of details when it comes to others. So they have to get the right costume down, for example. But they're not interested in the authenticity of the people that they're dealing with. So all of these Vietnamese people who've been brought in to have roles in this American epic about the Vietnam War literally have nothing to say. And their function is to literally just be stage props for an American drama. And my narrator understands this. He understands it very intellectually and viscerally, that what is happening here is that Hollywood is the unofficial ministry of propaganda for the Pentagon, that its role is to basically prepare Americans to go fight wars by making them focus only on the American understanding of things, and to understand others as alien and different and marginal, even to their own histories, right? And so his belief is that he can somehow try to subvert this ministry of propaganda, this vast war epic that is going to continue to kill Vietnamese people in a cinematic fashion, which is simply the prelude to actually killing Vietnamese people in real life. So he believes that he can try to make a difference, and of course the humor and the tragedy is that he can't.
Well, you know, they're not hiring any Vietnamese actors, and he's told that there aren't any, or those that exist aren't talented enough. So at least he's able to find Vietnamese actors who can be extras. And then he sees, like, the cast at the end, and they're all hired as, like, rape victim number one, rape victim number two. So even that ends up being very discouraging for him. You know, one of the things you say about the war and Hollywood is that, like, this is one war where the losers get to write the story.
Yeah, and that's one of the tremendous ironies, you know, that the United States lost the war, in fact, in 1975. But for the very same reason that the United States was able to wage a war in which it lost 58,000 American soldiers, which is a human tragedy, but was able to create the conditions by which 3 million Vietnamese people died of all sides, and 3 million Laotians and Cambodians died during those years and in the years afterwards, for the very same reasons that the industrial power of the United States is able to produce this vast inequity of death. That's the same reason that the United States in the years afterward, through its incredibly powerful cultural industry, is able to win the war in memory, because wherever you go outside of Vietnam, you have to deal with American memories of the Vietnam War. Inside Vietnam, you have to confront Vietnamese memories. But outside, wherever I've gone and talked about the Vietnam War in memory, one of the first questions that I get is, what do you think of Apocalypse Now? So that's what we have to confront, right? That American soft power is tremendously powerful, and it goes hand in hand with American hard power.
Of course, so many of the movies made about Vietnam are about the divisions in America about whether it was a just war or not and whether American soldiers committed atrocities or not.
Yeah, and this is one of the things that people have a hard time getting their minds around. I often get questions, people saying, well, if you look at these Vietnam War movies, Americans come off really badly. And my response to that is, yes, that's true, but they're still the movie stars. And given an option between being a virtuous extra who gets to say nothing and being the demonic anti-hero who occupies center stage, I think everybody would choose being the demonic anti-hero. And that's what's happening. The basic reality of the Vietnam War that Americans can't get around is that it was, in many ways, a really bad war. And so Hollywood has at least acknowledged that much. But the way that it has contained the meaning of that war is to make Americans the stars of this drama and relegate the Vietnamese to the margins, even though in reality, the Vietnamese paid the heaviest price. As we confront the same parallel or analogous situations in the Middle East, the irony is that, you know, it's mostly people from these other countries that are dying, but Americans are preoccupied with their own experiences. That's an exact replication of the mindset that got us into Vietnam and that has now allowed Americans to remember the Vietnam War in a certain way that makes it an American war.
Do you see your novel, The Sympathizer, in part as an answer to that, as an alternative way of seeing the war, a way of seeing it through Vietnamese eyes as opposed to through American eyes?
You know, absolutely. It's my revenge on Francis Ford Coppola, my revenge on Hollywood, to try to get Americans to understand that Vietnam is a country and not a war.
So your first name is Viet, which is, I think, a very common name for people from Vietnam. It's also the first half of the name of the country that you were born in, Vietnam. What does Viet mean?
Viet just means the name of the people. So my parents chose for me a very nationalist and patriotic name, and in combination with my last name, Nguyen, I'm basically John Smith in Vietnam. But what's also interesting is that even as common as that name is, my name is for Vietnamese people here in the United States, it's obviously, for most Americans, a very foreign name that they have a hard time getting their tongue around. But I've never changed my name because I think for whatever reason, as ambivalent as I feel about coming from Vietnam, especially, you know, when I was an adolescent growing up in the United States, as ambivalent as I felt about it, I also felt that I was Vietnamese. And whether or not Vietnamese people accept me as Vietnamese or see me as authentically Vietnamese, I always felt that there was a part of me that had been marked by being born in Vietnam, that had been marked indelibly by being a refugee, by war, and that I would not give up my name for anybody. My parents, for example, I think are more pragmatic. They've adopted American names legally, even though they're very,
really?
very
Your
Vietnamese.
Parents changed
yeah,
names.
They have. in the Vietnamese community, they go by their Vietnamese names, but they're very pragmatic. As business people outside of that community, they go by their American names on their driver's licenses. And I had that option when we became citizens to change my name, and I thought, maybe I can be Troy. Whatever name I tried. So you laughed. Nothing sounded right. Nothing sounded right except my own name. So I've always stayed with it despite the minor costs that it might have entailed in terms of not seeming to be quite as American as everybody else. But obviously, the ambition is to make Americans say my name, to make Americans recognize that this is also now an American name. It is also now a French name. It is also now an Australian name. My surname, Nguyen, is the fourth most popular surname in Australia. You know, we've transformed the countries that we've come to, and the people who live in these countries will eventually be able to say our names in the same ways that they say Coppola.
Well, Viet, thank you so much for talking with us, and congratulations on winning the Pulitzer.
Thank you so much for having me, Terry. It's been a pleasure.
Viet Thanh Nguyen is the author of the book The Sympathizer. He spoke with Terry last Tuesday. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Heidi Simon. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Teresa Madden, and Thea Challoner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.